Okay, yeah, we just finished the serambicity, and now we're heading into the chrysomelody. And your first one, does your thing say brucidi or brucini?
Brucini.
Knee? Okay, you got the corrected one.
Okay.
This was it used to be a separate family, and now it's been rolled into the chrysomelody. So, to me, again, it's not one of my favorite moves because the brucini just looked different to me. But anyway, the chrysomelody. This is a large family. It's the fourth largest family with 1,500 species. The antennae, if you remember, the two families we're really talking about in the chrysomeloidea is the serambicidae and then this one. And serambicidae have the long antennae. These usually have antennae that are half the length of the body or shorter. Again, there's one subfamily, the Donacinae, that's a little bit exceptional in that regard. But anyway, the antennae are usually less than half the length of the body, maybe filiform, serrate, or clavate. The eyes are usually entire. Remember in the serambicidae, a lot of times anyway, the eyes were emarginate. Mm-hmm. The shape can be variable. These tend to be a little bit smaller than a lot of serambicids, usually less than 12 millimeters. Again, the tarsal formula, same as this superfamily, it's apparently 4-4-4, meaning it's truly 5-5-5, but the one segment's very small. The adults and immatures are phytophagous, feeding on living plants, mostly herbaceous ones, although there are some that attack trees. Usually on the leaves, or there are some that feed on roots. We have a number of rootworms. The immatures are down on the roots that are pests. This family also includes things like the Colorado potato beetle, some leaf miners, things that the immatures actually burrow into the tissue of leaves. You can see these pale mines through the leaves. This is another large family, and so we'll at least talk about a number of the subfamilies. This first one, as I said, the Brucini, used to be its own family, and now it's become a subfamily within the Chrysomelidae. These are called the seed beetles. You can see the head is kind of deflects downwards. It's relatively broad, not really like a snout like in the weevils, but almost kind of like the beginnings of a head being projected out in front or downwards. The body is oval, somewhat narrowed anteriorly. You can kind of see the pronotum in the head's more narrow than the elytra is. Antennae are usually clavate or serrate. This family, it's a little bit exceptional in that the eyes are somewhat notched.
Notched.
Yeah, emarginate. Generally, the chrysomelidae, they're not. The serambicidae were, but this one's a little bit different. The elytra tend to be striate, meaning they have longitudinal grooves. You can see on there. Called seed beetles because the immatures often are little larvae that feed on seeds. Mostly of various legumes. Some develop in stored dried seeds, so they can be stored grain pests. They're kind of distinctive. They're, like I said, they're a little bit more robust looking beetles with a broad, somewhat prolonged head. Now, the next handout, the next subfamily that I'd like to mention is on the left-hand side of this one. It's the subfamily Donaceanae. So the Donaceanae, here the antennae are a little bit longer. They're half the length or just maybe a little bit longer. These are often somewhat metallic in color, kind of yellowish or greenish-yellow, somewhat bluish metallic beetles. I may have mentioned these on one of our field trips. They, probably when we were down there at the Muir Pool area, but these feed kind of on aquatic plants. You'll find them out on lily pads or on other plants. Like I said, this Ed Riley and I, on one of our collecting trips down there, we managed to get a rowboat and we rowed out and collected these off lily pads and stuff. I've been fishing up in northern Minnesota and we'd be fishing up around the lily pads and that and catch these again on the flowers and on the lily pads. Sometimes you turn the leaf upside down and you'll find them underneath. So the larvae feed on submerged parts of aquatic plants. That's where you often find these. Let's see, what else do we have? I've X'd out the one in the bottom center we don't follow. The rest of that, those are the Ordaceanae. I don't think we cover that. We don't cover that family, so either subfamily either. So there's a lot of subfamilies in the Chrysomelidae. We only cover a few of them. One of them we do talk about is the Chrysomelinae, which is on this one, striped beetle in the upper left-hand corner. And that's the Colorado potato beetle. Probably can't guess what plant it feeds on.
Potatoes.
Good. There is another beetle that looks a lot like it that doesn't feed on potatoes. God, I can't remember the common name of it right now. Some of these also feed on trees. The yellow margin leaf beetle, well, it gets on turnip, mustard, cabbage, but there's one called the cottonwood leaf beetle. One clear over the far right is one of those, I think. The second from the right is in the genus Calligrapha. I guess somebody thought somebody took a calligraphy pen to make those markings on its back. They're kind of strange in that. So there's a number of species of Calligrapha. Most of the time I've caught Calligrapha, and they occur up here. We can get those fancy looking Chrysomelidae, like on birch trees and maybe aspen and things like that. Here in this subfamily, the third tarsal segment's not always lobed. It's usually lobed in the other subfamilies, but it's not always lobed in this one. Of course, with the potato crop up here, the Colorado potato beetle is a problem. They've actually used stink bugs as biocontrol for it and other things. So let's see. This one, next one is the Gallerousinae. It's written on there too, but the Gallerousinae. These often tend to be a little bit more softer bodied. They're not as rigid or hard as in some others. This subfamily includes the genus Diabrotica, which Diabrotica, is it spelled out on there any place? I don't see that it is. Anyway, Diabrotica. In includes some of the rootworms. The banded cucumber beetle, the spotted cucumber beetle, or sometimes called the southern corn rootworm. And there's a number of these rootworms that are considered to be major pests. The striped cucumber beetle is in a different genus, the Acalymma. So a lot of things that are on, they're pests. The beetles, the adults, a lot of times you see them on the cucurbits, like I said, the cucumbers and stuff. But the immatures, a lot of times, are even on corn and things, feeding on the corn roots. So the this subfamily, the pronotum is margined laterally, so it has a sharp edge along the lateral margins. Now, there used to be another subfamily called the Altissini that was now been rolled into the Gallerusini. And so this next handout says Altissini, like over there on the left-hand side in that. But these are still now, these are now in the Gallerusini still. But these, the Altissini, are commonly called flea beetles. You've probably heard of flea beetles. And they do jump sometimes. Some of the smaller ones are pretty good jumpers. Some of these bigger ones, they try, but they don't really jump very well. But the Altissini, these are the flea beetles. Adults feed on foliage and eat tiny holes in the leaves. The larvae, again, feed on roots. Don't have this handout.
Unless it's further back.
It may have had them in a different order, and it got rolled, like I said, they got rolled in with the Gallerusini, so I moved it up.
It is after the... good question of what to say it's after. After the page with, it's after this page.
Yeah, he found it too.
Okay.
So yeah, I put it up right after the Gallerusini because these are now in market, that they're now in the Gallerusini. Again, they're the flea beetles. There's one that gets on like tomato plants and eggplants, solanaceous plants. It can be a pest in gardens and stuff. I think there's one that gets like on alligator weed in wet ditches and stuff. This one on the top row to the right there, that's looks like it's got pale stripes. It's black and does have pale stripes. It's often marked with red on it too. It's a really pretty flea beetle, but it occurs around here also. I've caught it down there at Muir Pool quite often actually, or ones like it anyway.
Shows in the large femur, is that pretty common for this subfamily?
Yeah, because of the jumping habits, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to talk about one more subfamily. Again, you've got handouts for quite a few. But again, the next subfamily is actually two subfamilies that have been put together. This is the... is it written on here? It's not on here. This is the Hispini. It's the one with the basswood leaf miner in the upper left-hand corner. These are leaf miners. The immatures are actually in the tissue of leaves and leave that kind of a pale path sometimes. It's not always these beetles. There's flies that are leaf miners and things too. But anyway, the Hispini, these are leaf mining beetles. They have distinct ridges that border rows of punctures on their elytra. Some kind of have the antennae somewhat clubbed. These are pretty distinctive looking when you find them in your net. and they're a little bit flattened, but they're a little bit more squarish in shape. What I'm getting at is that your next handout used to be a different subfamily, the Cassidinae, but they're the tortoise beetles. So the tortoise beetles are no longer in their own subfamily. Anything else I want to say? These are somewhat narrowed head and mouth parts, ventral, directed ventrally or posteriorly, and it is the larvae that mine in the leaves. These, what I remember about these is, again, this is Ed Reilly's favorite group that he liked to collect Chrysomelidae, and the hispines and the cassidines are what he's particularly like. But I remember down in the tropics, I don't know if you know how the, like banana plants and related banana flowers, they have those really long leaves. Well, they're in a tight whorl as they're coming up out of the stem. Mm-hmm. And you can grab hold of one of those leaves and pull it out and then unwhirl it, open it all up, and these beetles and their immatures would be down in the middle of that whorl feeding on the plants. So again, if you know how, normally you wouldn't see a lot of these beetles in that down there, but if you know to pull that out, open that up. Remember doing that and finding lots of hispine beetles. Now, like I said, this used to be the next one that has these tortoise beetle. Used to be its own subfamily, the Cassidinae. So these used to be Cassidinae. But I'll draw a line through it because now they've been rolled in with the hispine. Which again, I guess there's ways that these two are closely related, but tortoise beetles just look like tortoise beetles and they look different than hispiney, but these, huh?
They look very amazing.
Yeah. Called tortoise beetles because they do have the edges of the pronotum and the elytra often flared out laterally and forwards and that makes them look like a little turtle.
You really see the head from the top, from top view.
Right, the head is usually concealed by the pronotum.
Almost a see-through, obviously.
A few are somewhat shaped like lady beetles. The one in the lower left-hand corner doesn't look like much, but it's actually dark metallic blue. And it gets on palms, little low-growing palms down in the southeastern United States, and they've got suction cups or something on their feet that they can attach themselves to the leaf very tight. There's been studies done, you know, ants trying to get after them. You can't hardly pry them off the leaf, and so they've been studied how they can grab hold of the leaf so tight, and of course with that shape of their body they can, just like a little dome, hard to get to. You may recognize some of those others, like lower middle or the upper right. We have some around here that look like that. There's some big ones that occur around here, too. The thing is, they're beautiful when they're in life, at least some of them. And some can kind of change color, but after you kill them, a lot of times the beautiful colors fade away. They just become kind of yellowish in color and that. So, but there's lots and lots of species. Down in the tropics, there's great big ones that are bright blue with red colors and stuff on them and that. So, the head is opisthonathous, so the mouth parts are kind of directed backwards. They tend to feed on plants in the morning glory family, Convolvulaceae. Anybody know a crop in the morning glory family, Convolvulaceae? It's not one that you probably would think of, but it kind of fools you. But sweet potatoes. Sweet potatoes are not related to regular potatoes at all. You know, regular potatoes are related to tomatoes. They're Solanum, Solanaceous. Mm-hmm. But sweet potatoes are in the morning glory family. The genus is Ipomaea, I believe, but it's related to the convolvulus. And so some of these, there's actually some tortoise beetles that are pests of sweet potatoes. So anyway, that's the Chrysomelidae. Again, there's a lot more subfamilies. Jerry's giving you handouts of some of these. The next handout, you can see there's some that actually kind of are camouflaged. They look like caterpillar poop. That one you can see up in the right-hand corner, it's called Neoclamisus, Clamisini. It pulls its legs in close and it just looks like a little caterpillar poop. So there's some others in here, the Cryptocephalini. All of these we can catch around here. So the next one, there's some of the asparagus beetles, which Jerry says some of these do occur around here. I asked him because I see asparagus all over the place, and I've caught asparagus beetles down in Indiana where we had some asparagus, but I hadn't really caught very many up here anyway. Maybe some. Again, there's a lot of asparagus growing up there in the prairie west of Grand Forks, and we might have got some asparagus beetles up there. That's the subfamily Creocerinae. There's the Umaltini. That one that's lower right-hand corner, the Great Calaspis. It's a pest on some trees, and that, at least in the southern United States. There's one called a rose leaf beetle. Another subfamily that's got important pests. But anyway, that'll finish up the Chrysomelidae. Now we'll do the Curculionidae, or the Curculionoidea. So now we're moving into the Curculionoidea. These are the weevils and some related families. And early on, I told you, here, a lot of these families, the head will be somewhat prolonged out in kind of a beak. Some of them not drastically. You can see this anthribity, they're not drawn out quite as much. But what one of the characters these families have is if you look under the underneath side, up under the head, kind of that head area, most beetles will have kind of a squarish plate, mm-hmm. and the head's on out here. I don't know, I'm not very good at drawing this. But there'll be a plate under here that's called the gula. Uh-huh. And these sutures on each side of it are called the gular sutures. Okay. Now, that plate can be wider or narrower. In the weevils, it's gotten narrower and narrower until there is no plate there anymore. Oftentimes, it'll just be a suture right down the middle, or there may not even be a suture. But what they call that is the gular sutures are fused. So fused gular sutures. And essentially, it's the gula has become so small it's not there anymore. And those two sutures have gotten closer and closer until they've become one.
And that occurs here?
In the Curculionoidea. So head is more or less prolonged into a beak or snout, except in this family it's not quite as much. And a couple subfamilies later on will. Oh, is that early picture of the crabbit shows the gula under there?
Yeah.
So, gular sutures are fused or lacking. Mm-hmm. Prosternal sutures are absent. The tarsal formula is, apparently 4-4-4. It's actually 5-5-5 with the fourth segment very small. Fourth segment's very small and concealed in the lobed third segment. This superfamily contains a number of families, the largest of which is the Curculionidae, which we'll get to in a minute. There's a few other smaller families that I would like to mention. This first one is the Anthribidae, which are the fungus weevils. And the head, it's kind of deflects downward and it's kind of broad. You can kind of tell it's just before it's gotten prolonged out into a beak. So it's really not prolonged out into a beak as much, but it's, again, almost kind of like the Bruchini. It's broad and starting to look projecting downwards, but not really out into a beak-like structure yet. Here, the antennae are more or less straight, as we'll see when we get to the true Curculionidae. It's more or less elbowed. But here they're straight, usually 11 segmented, often with a 3-segmented club. Some have the antennae relatively long. Here the base of the pronotum is kind of truncate, and there's often a ridge that kind of follows that posterior margin. So there's kind of a ridge in a lot of the species that follows the posterior margin of the pronotum. Tarsal formula is apparently 444, or occasionally it may even look like 333.
Some tarsals are that reduced?
Yeah. Yep, it says tarsal formula is apparently 444 or 333. It's actually 555 with the second segment apically emarginate and partially enclosing the third segment, which is bilobed. Fourth segment minute. A lot of times you can see the pygidium either dorsally or from the posterior margin. You can see this kind of sticking out, maybe just a little bit there. So pygidium is partially exposed in posterior view, but usually not very visible from above. So you can see the pygidium looking at it from behind, but you can't see it very well from above. The adults are found on dead twigs or beneath loose bark. The larvae are kind of vary in habit, but often found on woody fungi, hence the name fungus beetle or weevils. Coffee bean weevil is an important pest of seeds, berries, and dried fruits. Now, the next one.
The pygidium, that's not the term. What is the pygidium?
Pygidium is the last abdominal tergite.
Oh,
yeah, the top. Now, we talk about the Atelabidae mainly because there is one around here that's fairly common. That picture in the center there, the rose curculio, is usually, it's bright red in color, and we find it on our wild roses out on the prairie. During the summer months, you can catch this. These are called, well, it says leaf and bud weevils. Atelabidae, I thought there was a different name. Well, they're sometimes called the tooth-nosed weevils, and it's because the mandibles out here have these teeth.
Oh.
But it's a small group. I don't usually spend a lot of time on this group, just pointing out that it has the teeth on the mandibles, so they're sometimes called tooth-nosed weevils. Again, you can see the antennae are not elbowed, And again, that one in the bottom center is usually fairly bright red in color. It's on the wild roses around here. The next family, which is actually the next two handouts, again, it's two families have been put together again, but we now have the Brentidae. And again, this one still has the antennae more or less straight, not elbowed. And in this family, the beak, which can be very elongate, the beak sometimes can be almost as long as the body in some of the tropical species, but it goes out straight out in front of the head. It's not going downward like you see in most weevils. So these are the straight-snouted weevils. They are elongate, parallel-sided. The prothorax is kind of pear-shaped. So you can kind of see how that is kind of pear-shaped. They have a very long beak. It's longer in the females. Like I said, I've caught these down, and again, in the tropics where the beetles are, the body's like that, and when you add on the snout, it doubles the length of them. Very long snouts. These have been collected down in the Mirpool area, so we can get Brentids up here. Again, the antennae are somewhat thread-like. This part of the family is not generally an economic group. Again, you find these in dead logs and rotten logs and under bark and that sort of thing, under loose bark. Few can be sometimes associated with ants. Sometimes they feed on fungi. But, as I said, the next handout, this used to be its own family, and now they're in the Brentidae also. But it's the subfamily Apionidae. And you can see, this one doesn't bother me. You can see why this might now be Brentids. They're kind of still the same shape, and the snout goes out straight out in front. Mm-hmm. And the antennae are not elbowed. But the one on the left is a hollyhock weevil. And I have collected these in my backyard on hollyhock, so they're around here. And then the one to the right, being the center of this handout, is called the sweet potato weevil. And it is a pest on sweet potatoes. It's actually, this is more of a pest than the lady beetles are, or the, not lady beetles, the tortoise beetles. Mm-hmm. The tortoise beetles, the adults tend to feed on the leaves. I don't think the immatures are too much of a pest. But these weevils, the adults will feed on the leaves, but the immatures burrow into the sweet potatoes. And that was one of the, like I said, I worked for a guy down there, kind of as a postdoc, who was breeding sweet potatoes. And some different varieties of sweet potatoes have more resistance to these, that the larvae don't like to feed on them. And so that's what he was, one of the main things. There was white grubs also, some of the June bugs larvae would be getting into some of the, feeding on some of the sweet potatoes. But then these were about the next, or one of the big pests, and we were trying to breed varieties that were resistant. And he came up with this Beauregard variety that this thing didn't seem to bother too much. And so, but anyway, used to be the Apionidae, now it's a subfamily within the weevils. And then that brings us, I believe, to the weevils. Curculionidae. Mm-hmm. And now head more or less prolonged out on a beak as a beak, and now the antennae are somewhat geniculate, and you can see they come off the head kind of on that beak or on the base of the beak or out on the beak a little bit. So this is a large family, 50,000 species worldwide. There's more than 2,500 in North America, We have probably around 250 here in North Dakota alone. Most species have a fairly well-developed snout. Antennae are usually elbowed with a compact terminal club. The basal segment often received in grooves on the snout, so they have little grooves on the snout where the basal, or the first antennal segment, kind of can fit into. Almost all weevils are plant feeders. Many are serious pests. Almost every part of the plant can be attacked from the roots upwards. The larvae are often feed inside the tissues. Adults drill holes in fruits and nuts. Some are used as biocontrol agents for invasive weeds. Now, as with any of these large families, there's lots of subfamilies, and I've never required any of the subfamilies until they made one change, and so now I do have one subfamily that we require. For the most part, weevils are weevils type of thing that geniculate clubbed antennae. And you can see, again, lots of examples of them. I think I told you about one around here that's on oak trees that has the really long snout that so it can bore into the acorns. I don't know that we got any on any of our field trips, but usually late in the year I still get them. This is also, I think I've talked about the O'Briens, this couple that he worked on weevils and she worked on fulgorids. But he collected all over the world and collected everything and did a lot of trading, and everybody else would send his weevils. So he had millions of specimens of weevils from all over the world. And they've since retired, moved to Arizona, and I think they donated their whole collection to one of the universities in Arizona. So it's kind of like the center of weevil research now, this university in Arizona. But the one subfamily that I now have added is one that used to be a separate family. And it's the bark beetles, which don't really look much like weevils, but they have the Gular suture fused and has the other characters of weevils. And so now they consider this a subfamily of the Curculionidae. So it's the Scolytinae.
This online at some point.
What's that?
I think I saw this on one of the Facebook pages that I'm a part of.
Oh yeah.
What? Entomology calls this a forbidden licorice beetle.
Forbidden licorice beetle.
I don't know. Like I said, just saw today.
Yeah. Like I said, I warned you several lectures ago, what you're apt to confuse these with are actually the Bostrichidae. We talked about the Bostrichids earlier, and they're a little bit larger, but they don't have the antennae elbowed like we see in this. And also notice how the club is very compact. We said that the Scolytids had a very compact, I believe, three-segmented club, almost ball-shaped, whereas the Bostrichids, it's more of a clavate-type club. It's not ball-shaped or compact like we see here. But it's the same thing. These are elongate, kind of cylindrical insects. Oftentimes, they've kind of got these striae. Oftentimes, at the posterior end, it'll be kind of hollowed out, and there'll be some spines. See that lateral view in the one lower center. But we also saw that sometimes in some of the Bostrichids too, that there can be kind of hollowed out and some spines posteriorly. Again, the antennae are short, elbowed with a compact club. Here the tarsal formula is apparently 4-4-4. It's 5-5-5 with the fourth very small. Sometimes the head is covered by the pronotum, sometimes it's not. Sometimes you can see the head from above, but oftentimes you cannot. Again, they're kind of roughened, striate bodies. Again, bark beetles live within the bark of trees, usually right on the surface of the wood part. You'll see, if you tear off the loose bark off of a tree, you often will find these larger galleries. Mm-hmm. The adult usually chews this central gallery and lays eggs, and it's the immatures that then burrow out to the sides. In some species, it's oriented this way. Sometimes it'll be oriented the other way in different species. These tend to attack dead trees or diseased, unhealthy trees. When numbers build up is when you start getting problems. For example, in the south, if a hurricane goes through and knocks down a lot of trees, there's a lot of food available, so populations will get really high, and then you'll start seeing them spill over onto healthier trees. Tree death may either be by girdling or by fungi introduced by the adults and spread by the larvae. They have the ability to attack a tree in mass, meaning they put out aggregation pheromones when they find a good food source, and that'll attract more individuals in. Again, spreading fungi. The fungi can stain the wood, so it's not even usable for lumber and that sort of thing. Bark beetles probably have a greater impact on our country's forests than any other insect group. A lot of them, especially on pines and things like that. Ips is one of the important genera, IPS. What's that?
Scolitis.
Yeah, that's probably another one, but yeah. And of course, around here, the big one is the European elm bark beetle, which spreads the Dutch elm disease. And so that's why we're actually fairly lucky. We still have quite a few elm trees. That hasn't killed all our elm trees, but some areas of the country essentially don't have any of the original elm trees anymore. They've brought in some from other countries, from Europe and that have some resistance, but it's a different species in that. So we still have a lot of, they try to protect, they actually try to inoculate the trees. You'll see them go around in the spring with a big machine with some hoses and actually inject some antifungal stuff right into the tree near the base at the ground and that to try to slow down the fungal. But it's also one of those where that fungus doesn't, it's not always just the beetles. They can transmit the fungus from tree to tree through the root system too. So, but anyway, that is the beetles. And I will hit